Okay, let's unpack this. You shared a really deep stack of research with us. Stuff ranging from, well, ancient philosophical frameworks for problem solving, all the way to the latest in video game engine optimization.
Quite the mix, yeah.
Right. So our mission today is this deep dive. We're aiming to build a kind of mental toolkit for you. We'll cover computational thinking, figure out how to measure algorithmic efficiency, and then see how that rigor applies to, technical careers.
Basically, turning all that material into something clear and actionable.
Exactly. And we are starting with, I think, the ultimate foundational question. When you're faced with some massive, daunting challenge, how do you make sure you are solving the right problem, not just, the easiest one that pops up?
It's the central tension, really, in engineering and design everywhere. Probably the most enduring guide for navigating this actually comes from mathematician Georges Paulea. He outlined four approaches.
Huh, Paulia.
Yeah, focus primarily on mathematical problem solving, but honestly, they're pretty universal in how they apply.
I like starting here. It sort of grounds all the technical stuff we'll get into later in, well, in philosophy. So what did Paulia say you had to do for any successful solution attempt?
His steps are just a masterclass in structured thinking, really. First, understand the problem. You absolutely must clarify every unknown, every constraint.
Okay, step one, understand.
Second, devise a plan. Outline your strategy. How are you going to attack this? Third, carry out the plan. Actually execute the steps he laid out.
Makes sense. Do the work.
And then, crucially, fourth, look back. Review your work, verify the results, check if it actually solved the original problem. That last step, that's often the difference between just a functional solution and a really optimized one.
Look back. Got it. And there's a fascinating little nugget about Paulia himself, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
He immigrated back in 1933, ended up teaching at Stanford,
Yeah.
and his big book, How to Solve It, was actually rejected by four different publishers.
No kidding. Four.
Four. Before it finally got published in 1945. And then, boom, it becomes one of the most successful mathematical books ever. It kind of proved that devising a plan and carrying it out, that persistence, applies just as much to getting published as it does to calculus problems.
Huh. That's a great story. And it provides a central context, actually, because Paulia's framework, it maps almost directly onto modern problem-solving methods we use today.
Like computational thinking.
Exactly. Specifically, those steps required to understand and plan a solution, they're formalized today under the umbrella of computational thinking, or CT.
Right. CT, that's like the mental discipline for breaking down a really complex task, isn't it?
Precisely.
It sort of boils down the process into four core mental components based on the sources we looked at.
Yeah.
The first one is decomposition. So taking that big complex problem, could be a software bug, could be a messy business process, whatever, and breaking it down into smaller, more manageable, hopefully independent components. Can't fix the whole thing until you understand the parts, right?
Absolutely. Break it down first. Then, once it's decomposed, you engage pattern recognition.
Okay.
This is where experience really kicks in. You start looking for similarities, repeating features, commonalities across those smaller components you just made. The question becomes, have I seen something like this little piece before? Can I reuse a solution?
Ah, so you're not reinventing the wheel every single time.
Hopefully not. And the third step, abstraction. This is where the real efficiency thinking starts to happen.
Abstraction sounds abstract.
Well, it's about simplifying complexity. It means ruthlessly ignoring the irrelevant details, all the noise, and focusing only on the most critical parts, the signal.
Okay, give me an example.
Sure. Like if you're analyzing why a web page is loading slowly, I don't know, the color scheme of the site,
Right.
that's probably noise.
Right. Doesn't matter for speed.
Exactly, but the time it takes to query the database, that's likely a critical signal. So you abstract away the colors, the fonts maybe, and focus your energy on that database query time. You eliminate what doesn't matter so you can focus resources where they actually count.
Okay, that makes sense. Noise versus signal. Got it.
And finally, those first three steps, decomposition, pattern recognition, abstraction, they all lead into logical thinking.
The planning part.
Pretty much, yeah. It's the Paulia-esque planning phase. Crafting that step-by-step strategy for solving the abstracted components you identified. What steps are required in what order? What specific resources are needed at each point? It's the roadmap.
And these CP processes, they aren't just theoretical, right? They're directly applied in frameworks people use every day, like design thinking.
Oh, absolutely. Design thinking basically takes these analytical CT tools and wraps them in a very human-centered approach. It always starts with applying empathy.
Which sounds a lot like Polya's understand the problem,
yep,
but maybe more focused on the person experiencing it.
Exactly. Understanding the human needs first. Then you focus on making sure you solve the right problem. Is this target actually actionable and meaningful for that person?
Okay.
Next, you ideate. This is the heavy lifting where you apply those CT processes, decomposition, pattern recognition, abstraction, logical planning to brainstorm potential solutions.
Right, the creative part grounded in analysis.
Then you prototype some of those ideas, build a rough version, and finally, you reflect and evaluate, which is essentially Polya's look back, testing the prototype, getting feedback, refining it.
That focus you mentioned on solving the right problem, that brings us right back to humanizing the whole process.
Mm.
The methodology we looked at really emphasized identifying the actors involved,
mm-hmm,
because knowing who is affected helps define what you're actually trying to fix, doesn't it?
Precisely. If you don't know who you're solving for, how can you know if you succeeded? We need to distinguish between usually three types of actors.
Okay, who are they?
There's the core actor. That's the person or group experiencing the problem firsthand. Then there's the direct actor, someone who interacts directly with the core actor or maybe with the system or solution itself.
Right.
And finally, the indirect actor. This is someone who might be affected by the consequences of the solution, maybe downstream, even if they never actually touch the system themselves. Think about like support staff or administrators.
Got it. Core, direct, indirect. And understanding those actors drives those six steps we saw for framing the solution concisely.
Exactly. That framework helps you nail it down. First, identify that core individual or group. Second, state their needs using action verbs like needs to access information quickly, not just needs information. Be specific.
Verb, okay. Actionable.
Third, list all the involved actors' core, direct, indirect. Fourth, detail the pains and gains for each actor involved. What are they struggling with now? What would a good solution actually achieve for them?
Pains and gains. That sounds very user-centric.
It is. And the ultimate goal, the sort of distilled outcome of all that work, is a really precisely framed problem statement. The most effective structure we found turns a vague complaint into an actionable challenge.
And that structure what?
It's simple but powerful. The customer actor needs a way to do something specific, the verb, so that achieve a specific benefit outcome.
Ah, customer needs a way to blank so that blank.
Exactly. That concise sentence, needs, means, and outcome, that becomes your guiding star. It's the gateway to a successful plan because everyone's aligned on the real goal.
That's really powerful. It forces you to apply that abstraction we talked about, right? Eliminate the noise before you even start building or coding anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you fail to define the problem correctly up front, you end up maybe tackling these huge, complex systemic issues blindly. Like that burnout loop model mentioned in the source material.
Right, the one connecting things like assignment rate, work pressure, corner cutting.
Yeah, exactly. Those are super complex systems. You'd absolutely need decomposition and probably some way to visualize the connections to even start understanding them.
Visualizing complexity is definitely a key application of decomposition. The material also mentioned the Ishikawa fish bone diagram. Remember that one?
Vaguely.
Yeah.
Remind me.
It's a great cause and effect tool. It helps you analyze problems by categorizing potential root causes into these standard groups like management, process, people, IT, environment, materials. It's a systematic way to check, okay, where could this problem really be coming from?
Like a structured brainstorm for root causes. Okay.
Exactly. It helped you systematically check every potential source of the pain point before you jump to conclusions.
Okay, so we've used Polya, CT, and DT to understand the problem, frame it, maybe visualize it, and devise a plan. But once the plan is devised, we have to evaluate it, right? How good is this plan?
Mm.
And here is where I think it gets really interesting. We transition into the more technical side of things. Evaluating a solution's efficiency using Big O notation.
Ah, yes. Big O notation. Can't escape it in computer science.
So what is it, fundamentally?
Think of Big O, or more formally asymptotic notation, as a kind of mathematical shorthand. It's the standard measurement we use to assess the upper bound, so the worst case scenario of the time, or maybe the memory an algorithm takes to execute as the input size grows.
Upper bound, okay. Worst case.
Right. It lets us predict performance theoretically and evaluate efficiency. And the key variable is usually N, which represents the number of items in the input, or maybe the number of operations performed relative to that input size.
And comparing the different big O curves tells us if a solution will just, you know, work for small inputs or if it's truly scalable for massive ones.
Absolutely. That's the core value.
So let's look at some comparisons. Maybe start at the slower end of the spectrum.
Sure. We can use searching as a good example. Take O N. That's pronounced O of N. It represents linear time or a linear curve.
Linear.
Meaning the execution time increases directly in proportion to the number of items, N. If you're doing a simple linear search, just checking each item one by one to find, say, employee number 52 in a list of 52 employees.
You might have to check all 52, right?
Yeah.
In the worst case.
Exactly. So N equals 52 operations in the worst case. Mm. It works, but it's not great if N becomes, you know, a million.
Okay, so ON is our baseline check everything approach.
Yeah.
But if that list is sorted first.
Oh, yes. If it's sorted, we can unleash the powerhouse, O called on N, O of log N, the logarithmic curve.
Okay, hold on. The example given was searching a list of a trillion elements takes only around 40 steps.
Yeah.
How is that even possible? That sounds like magic.
It feels like magic, but it's just the power of logarithmic reduction. Think about finding a word in a huge physical dictionary.
Right. You don't start at page one.
Exactly. You open it roughly to the middle. You check if your word comes before or after that page. Huh. And then you instantly discard half the dictionary. Gone. You repeat that process. Open the remaining half to its middle. Compare, discard half again. Every single step, you eliminate 50% of the remaining search space. That incredible reduction rate is why a list of a trillion elements, which is roughly 2 to the power of 40, can be searched using a binary search in only about 40 steps.
Wow. Okay. Binary search, O log N.
Yeah.
Hugely efficient for large sorted data sets.
Massively efficient. Now, the ultimate goal, the sort of holy grail of efficiency, is the O1 constant curve. O of 1.
Constant time.
Like the algorithm takes the same fixed amount of time and resources to run, regardless of how big N gets. Whether you have 10 items or 10 billion, it takes the same time.
Have you achieved that?
Usually through very specific data structures and methods, like using hashing or hash tables for super fast lookups, you can essentially calculate the data's location almost immediately instead of searching for it.
Instant access, basically. O1. Very nice.
The gold standard, yeah. So when we look across the spectrum, we see the trade-offs. Efficient sorting algorithms, like the famous quicksort, they typically fall into the very respectable O(n) log n complexity class.
And log n. Better than n squared, but not as good as log n.
Right. Then on the less efficient end, you have simpler but sometimes naive algorithms like bubble sort, which often fall into O(n)(2), the quadratic curve.
N squared, meaning if you double the data.
You quadruple the processing time, roughly. It gets slow, fast. And then there's the truly terrifying end of the spectrum, like a brute force approach to certain problems, which can fall into O(n), the factorial curve.
Oh, factorial, like N times N1 times N2.
All the way down, time grows unbelievably fast. It makes problems essentially unsolvable for anything but the tiniest values of N in practice.
Yikes. Okay, so avoid O(n) if possible.
Definitely. The technical thinking required for developing these different algorithms actually reveals different mental approaches to optimization itself.
Awesome.
Well, the sources highlighted greedy algorithms, for instance. The thinking there is all about local optimization. At every step, you just pick the option that looks like the best choice right now, assuming that making the best local choice will eventually lead to the best overall global solution.
Sometimes works, sometimes doesn't.
Exactly. It builds intuition, but can get stuck in suboptimal solutions, which contrasts really nicely with dynamic programming.
Okay, dynamic programming. What's the core idea there?
Dynamic programming often uses a concept called memoization. It's like giving the algorithm a memory.
Memoization, like writing memos.
Sort of. If you're trying to solve a complex problem that involves solving smaller overlapping subproblems repeatedly, like finding the best route or calculating some expensive sequence, the thinking is, okay, I just solved this small subproblem. I'm going to store its result.
Save the answer.
Right. So if I encounter this exact same subproblem again later down the line, I won't waste time recalculating it. I'll just recall the stored result instantly. This ability to combine results, eliminate duplicate work, and recall past solutions is fundamental to optimizing really complex tasks.
Store and recall. Smart. Avoids redoing work.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's really fascinating here, and maybe a bit frustrating for developers, is that while Big O is theoretically beautiful and absolutely essential for designing algorithms,
There's a butt coming.
there's a but. In the real world, the actual wall clock time doesn't always perfectly match the theoretical Big O prediction.
Okay, why not?
While several real-world factors can mess with efficiency, regardless of how elegant your Big O measurement looks on paper,
Like what?
things like significant differences in computer hardware, CPU speed, memory, caching, huge variations in the actual data sets used as inputs, maybe your worst-case scenario almost never happens in
Right, the
practice.
theory assumes the worst case.
Exactly, and maybe one of the most critical factors for developers. The choice of compiler and even the programming language itself. The material was quite specific here.
What did it say?
It pointed out that dynamically typed languages, like Python, for example, are generally slower to process instructions at runtime compared to statically typed compiled languages like C or C++E. The overhead is just different.
So the language choice itself impacts the actual speed, even for algorithms with the same big O.
It definitely can, yeah. Constants and lower order terms that Big O ignores can matter in practice.
Okay, so if compilers and hardware can undermine theoretical efficiency, how do really high-stakes, performance-critical environments like, say, video game development, manage all this complexity? Let's zoom out to that world, specifically using Epic's Unreal Engine, which you included in your sources.
Game development is such a perfect proving ground for all these concepts we've been talking about. It's where theory hits the hard wall of real-time performance demands.
Because lag is death, right?
Pretty much. And a modern game development platform like Unreal Engine has to manage just staggering complexity. It's synthesizing all these different components, huge libraries of 3D asset resources, visual effects, and cinematic tools, often open source code access for customization, the integrated development environment, or IDE itself, plus specialized tools for developers, all within one application.
It's a beast. And the source material gave us some pretty detailed insight into the required toolset, right?
Yeah.
Mentioning the heavy use of Unreal Engine C++, Blake.
C++ is dominant for performance-critical game code.
And it provided resources for source code access and setup. It even seemed to suggest that, for certain tasks, some developers might prefer Unreal Engine's environment even over something standard like Microsoft Visual Studio.
Yeah, the integrated nature and specialized tools in engines like Unreal can be very powerful for game-specific workflows. It really highlights that this career path demands a deep mastery of analytical thinking.
How so? Connect it back for us.
Well, think about how decomposition applies. Game developers are constantly breaking down incredibly complex systems: the physics engine, the AI for hundreds of characters, the rendering pipeline that draws everything on screen into manageable modular code blocks.
Right, breaking the game down into smaller pieces.
And optimization using Big O concepts is absolutely paramount. If you have thousands of objects interacting in a scene, you simply cannot afford an ON2 algorithm for collision detection, for instance. It would grind the game to a halt.
So you need those faster algorithms.
You must master complexity analysis to ensure critical systems are hitting O log N, or ideally even O 1, for things like fast lookups, maybe quickly retrieving a player's inventory items from a data table.
That real-world constraint needing O1 lookups for a smooth experience, that's what separates code that just functions from code that delivers a truly lag-free, enjoyable experience for the player.
Absolutely. This whole deep dive really reinforces how essential these skills, from problem definition to complexity analysis, are for anyone looking at technical readiness, especially in demanding fields like computer science or game development.
The need for speed, but also the need for smart speed, is universal. Okay, so let's do a quick recap of the journey we took you on today.
Sounds good.
We started way back with George Pulley's four timeless rules for approaching any complex challenge. Then we moved through the structured mental processes of computational thinking, decomposition, pattern recognition, abstraction, and logical thinking.
Building blocks for tackling complexity.
Right. And we learned how to humanize the challenge using design thinking principles, focusing on identifying the actors and their real needs, framing the problem precisely with that needs a way to blank, so the blank structure.
Nail the problem first.
Then we jumped into the deep end with Big O notation, measuring the theoretical power and scalability of our solutions. We saw the incredible efficiency of O log N logarithmic search, saving you from checking a trillion items one by one.
Binary search for the win.
Definitely. And we touch on different algorithmic strategies like greedy approaches and dynamic programming with its clever memoization trick.
Different ways to think about optimization.
Which then led us to that important question you raised earlier, thinking about Polya again.
Ah, right.
If even his landmark book, How to Solve It, the book that became one of the most successful math books ever, was rejected 4 times. It really makes you think, how vital is that sheer persistence? Polya's step 3, carry out the plan, even when you face setbacks and resistance. Seems pretty important, doesn't it?
It really does. It's not just about having the right plan, but also the resilience to see it through, failures and all.
A great thought to reflect on for coding or any complex project.
Yeah.
And since we also established that those big O complexity measures are theoretical, right? They get impacted by real world stuff like hardware, data, and even the compiler choice. Remember Python versus C++?
Mm-hmm. The real world complicates things.
Okay, so here is something for you to mull over after this. Considering the absolutely massive scale of modern open world games and the increasing use of AI for things like procedural generation, which of those highly efficient big O concepts we discussed, O1, constant time, O log N, logarithmic time, or O N, log N, which one do you think is currently the most challenging to reliably achieve and maintain in a truly large-scale, real-time game environment, and why?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Lots of potential bottlenecks there. Food for thought, indeed.
Definitely something to chew on. Until next deep dive.